I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times.
This step of opening an injection site is a step that crosses the line. It crosses the line in the sense that it's illegal, number one, and that's the most important aspect from our perspective. But secondly, I don't think that there's any assurance that it would be effective to open up an injection site, and there's all sorts of collateral consequences to it that we think would be negative consequences that would not help in fighting this epidemic.
That was William McSwain. He's the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, talking with WHYY's Bobby Allen about filing a civil lawsuit against Safehouse earlier this week. That's the nonprofit that wants to open a safe injection site in Philadelphia to address the city's opioid crisis and would be the country's first facility of this kind. More than 1,000 drug users overdosed last year in Philadelphia. That's about three times the murder rate. The federal government is using a part of the Substance Abuse Act, known as the Crack House Statute, to prevent Safehouse from setting up their facility that would provide medical and counseling services. Later in the hour, Rhonda Goldfein, vice president of Safehouse, will join us along with Bo Kilmer from RAND, who has looked at the impact of supervised drug consumption sites in Canada and Europe. The U.S. Attorney's Office was not able to send anyone to participate in today's program, but we do have WHYY's Bobby Allen, and he is a reporter with Keystone Crossroads. Bobby, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
What's the significance of this lawsuit? And I have to say, it has kind of blown up as a big story across the country.
It really has. So it's only seven pages. It's probably the shortest lawsuit that the U.S. Attorney's Office has ever filed, but it might be one of the most significant in many years. And that's because Philly is one of about a dozen places that right now is debating this idea of a supervised injection site, and it's never been legally tested. So what this lawsuit is seeking is for a judge to legally clarify whether federal drug laws from the 70s and the 80s would prohibit something like a supervised injection site. And it really is sort of the latest battlefield in the conflict between state and federal drug laws.
Well, and this was, I don't think, a surprise. And I'm thinking of the interview that you did with Acting Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. This was a couple of months ago last year, where he seemed to indicate that this was coming.
Exactly. So Rosenstein with the Justice Department told me that, you know, if Philadelphia opens a supervised injection site, that the response would be swift and aggressive, right? The feds have been threatening to legally crack down for some time now. And just to be clear to listeners, there is no supervised injection site open right now in Philadelphia. Safehouse officials are raising money. They're scouting a site. They're in the process of trying to open one, and they hope to open one this year. But this legal challenge is probably going to prolong those efforts. So this lawsuit is not a criminal prosecution, right? They're not arresting anyone. They're not forfeiting property. It's a civil lawsuit looking for a judge's opinion, and that opinion could reverberate around the country.
We're really talking about a preemptive lawsuit in a way, as you said, and we'll be talking more about this later in the hour, but that Safehouse does not have a Safehouse yet.
That's right, yeah. And so U.S. prosecutors say, look, there's this provision of the Controlled Substances Act called the Crack House Statute, and what it prohibits is having any place, any physical place that makes, stores, distributes, or uses a controlled substance. And he, you know, Bill McSwain, the U.S. attorney, says it's pretty black and white. I mean, Safehouse is not going to be manufacturing or storing or distributing drugs, but it is a facility in which people bring their own opioids like fentanyl and will use them. And that is a controlled substance. And that would be, you know, it's basically sanctioned by the city of Philadelphia. Philadelphia officials are not giving it any taxpayer money. They're not formally involved, but Mayor Jim Kenney has given tacit approval to this, and District Attorney Larry Krasner said, I'm not going to prosecute anyone in this place. But when it comes to the federal authorities, they say we just can't stand by and let this illegal activity happen.
It's going to go before Judge Gerald McHugh. He's a U.S. District Court judge here in Philadelphia. What do we know about him? What do we know about the timetable?
I can't say too much about the judge, but in terms of the timetable, there will be a response filed by Safe House's attorneys. There will be hearings. Eventually, there will be the lawsuit is after a declaratory judgment, which is just lawyers speak for a legal opinion saying, yes, this is legal, yes, or, you know, no, this is not legal. And, you know, when you look at legal scholars who have studied this, it's not as clear as the U.S. attorney is making it out. There's a lot of debate as to whether this provision that was written in the 1980s was intended to block something like a medical facility whose express purpose is to save lives.
Because it was directed at crack houses, and that was a serious problem a couple of decades
ago. Exactly. It was written at the height of the crack epidemic to go after crack houses. It has since been used in a much broader way to go after raves, you know, in the 90s when people were using a lot of ecstasy, to go after concert venues where there was a lot of illegal drug use. Can it also be used to try to shut down a supervised injection site? That's the big question. We just don't know. This has never been tested. This nexus of a supervised injection site and federal drug laws, that nexus has never been tested in the courts.
And we'll be talking about that more a little bit later in the hour. And if you want to join our conversation, that's that phone number, I should say, is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Bobby, I mentioned in my introduction that more than 1,000 people overdosed in Philadelphia last year. We don't have the exact number. It's maybe more than 1,100 people. But nonetheless, Philadelphia is the largest city with the biggest opioid crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it really is hard to overstate how much of a scourge this is in so many communities in Philadelphia, especially in Kensington. It's something like 3 people a day are dying from an overdose in Philadelphia. It's, you know, 3 or 4 times the city's murder rate, and Philadelphia is one of the most murderous cities in America. So I think everyone who studies public health, everyone who is involved in responding to this crisis knows that more needs to be done. I will say preliminary estimates say around 1,100 people died from overdoses last year, which was the first drop in about 5 years.
Wow.
And city officials credit the wide distribution of Narcan, which reverses the effects of an overdose. Now, SEPTA workers, librarians, police officers, paramedics are all equipped with this, and it's saving lives. But still, more than 1,100 people dying in 1 year from overdoses, that's severe. That is really severe. And the advocates of Safe House say, look, this isn't the only response, but it needs to be on the table because desperate times call for desperate measures.
And interestingly, former Pennsylvania mayor, excuse me, governor, former Philadelphia mayor Ed Rendell is on the board of Safe House. As you mentioned, Bobby, the mayor of Philadelphia and also the district attorney, there is no city or tax money going into this, but nonetheless, they do support it. But it's interesting that these heavy hitters are involved in this.
Yeah. Former governor Ed Rendell early on was a supporter of Safe House. He had a personal experience where he had a friend who overdosed from opioids. It had a personal connection to him and really has a personal connection to so many people. I personally have a friend I went to college with. I had many classes with him in college. And 2 years ago, he died from an opioid overdose in the Philadelphia area. I mean, everyone knows someone who's been impacted by this crisis. It's not unusual to hear these personal stories, and they're tragic and they're sad. And the families say, we wish more could have been done. And the advocates say, look, one of the biggest predictors of whether or not someone will die or not while using dangerous opioids is whether that person is alone. If someone is using alone, they're more likely to die. If you go and use in a supervised injection site, the advocates of this would say, you're going to have medical professionals who can save your life. You'll have one more day to try to get into treatment. And a place like Safe House is not just a place where you go and shoot up. The idea is to try to be a bridge to other wraparound services like housing and counseling and to try to turn people's lives around. But to the federal government, it doesn't matter. It's a place where they're going to be using illegal narcotics.
Well, and we should say that it is a Schedule I drug. And interestingly, we'll be talking about more about this later in the hour, but marijuana becomes more legalized across the country. I don't know whether that will open the door to this or not, but it's interesting to look at drugs that are described by the federal government as illegal having some legality as we move from state to state.
That's right. And Bill McSwain, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, when I sat down in his office, he said, you know, those comparisons are completely not well-founded. He said no one is dying from, you know, smoking too much pot. Right. But when you use opioids, especially fentanyl, which could be, you know, it's so, so powerful and so unpredictable, why would we allow a site to open that he thinks would encourage more drug use, would condone drug use, and bring people in from all over the Philadelphia area to use these drugs? I mean, this is what he says. And he says it's true that in Canada and across Europe, these sites have been studied, but mm-hmm. nobody really knows what's going to happen in Philadelphia. Vancouver, where one has operated for, I think, more than 15 years, it's called Insight. Vancouver is very different than Philadelphia. Yeah. Just because there have been good results there doesn't mean there's going to be good results in Philadelphia. That's what the U.S. attorney says, and that's their very firm position.
Why is Philadelphia such a ground zero for this opioid crisis? Is it the high rate of poverty? Is it location?
You know, I think it's a multifaceted answer. There's a lot going on. I think in Philadelphia, poverty is so connected to pretty much all of the social and public health issues that officials are grappling with. But you know, there's for a long time has been some of the cheapest and most powerful heroin in Philadelphia. It's just been a problem for a really long time. Both the potency, the availability, and Kensington has for a long time been ground zero for the opioid crisis, really in America, right? I mean, it's national reporters have come to Philadelphia and have highlighted the city as being sort of a window into the country's opioid crisis.
What do you think happens next? You spent some time talking with the U.S. Attorney William McSwain and talking about specifically about this lawsuit. But based on your conversation, what should we anticipate coming from the U.S. Attorney's office?
Well, we're all waiting on the federal court to make a decision. Until then, and we have Rhonda here, so we could learn more about.
We will. She's waiting in the wings. Listening intently. Yes.
Exactly. Where Safe House is on their timeline. But, you know, Bill McSwain said if Safe House opens before there's an opinion, he might file an amended complaint, which would try to enjoin the site from opening, basically block it from opening. He's going to do everything he can to make sure this doesn't open. But he does see this as sort of this lawsuit as sort of an incremental, not over the top approach to the safe injection site. He said he could have waited until it opened and sent DEA agents, sent federal officials, made arrests. Instead, he did a 7-page civil lawsuit simply seeking a legal opinion. Right. Which is very different than some of the rhetoric you heard from Rod Rosenstein, who said, if you do this, the response is going to be swift and aggressive. I don't think any legal scholar would look at this lawsuit and say it's aggressive. Right. I think it's actually, and we could hear from Rhonda on this, but I actually think it's in Safe House's interest to have the law clarified because Safe House believes that if you look at the legislative intent of the Controlled Substances Act, like I mentioned, it was never meant to go after supervised injection sites. They think they have a case, and even Safe House wants a judge to rule because they think they're going to get a favorable ruling.
Well, we will pick up on all the things that you just said there, Bobby Allen, with our guests who are waiting in the wings. That's WHYY's Bobby Allen, reporter for Keystone Crossroads, getting us up to speed on a lawsuit filed earlier this week by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Philadelphia about a safe injection site that wants to open here in the city. Bobby, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marty.
Sure. And stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a quick recap here. Philadelphia was on track to become the first American city to have a supervised injection site, but these efforts hit a major hurdle this week when the U.S. Attorney's Office filed a lawsuit against the nonprofit established to run the facility. We were just talking with WHYY's Bobby Allen about what this lawsuit is all about. Let me now introduce our other guests who will stay with us for the rest of the hour. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Rhonda Goldfein. She is vice president and co-founder of Safe House, also the executive director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania. Rhonda, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center. And he has looked at some of these supervised injection sites in other countries around the world. And Bo Kilmer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
And let me play another clip from the interview that Bobby Allen did with William McSwain. He is the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. The office could not send anyone to be part of our conversation today. But nonetheless, let me go back and just play another clip.
We're not bringing a criminal case right now. We're not arresting anybody. We're not asking for forfeiture, as you mentioned. You know, that is an option under the law, is that if this sort of drug house were set up, we believe we'd be entitled to go in and try to forfeit the property. We're not trying to do that. We're trying to be reasonable and moderate and incremental. And fortunately, we live in a society where judges in courts get to determine what the law is. So let's take advantage of that. Let's go into court in a civil action. Let's see what the court decides. And we think that's not only in law enforcement's best interest, but we actually think that's in Safe House's best interest for them to know where they stand.
Well, let's find out. Rhonda, is this in Safe House's best interest?
Yes, we think it is. We have consistently maintained that we have a difference in opinion on the analysis of those federal laws. And so the idea that the U.S. Attorney's Office has now called the question, I think, puts us all in a step forward. I would agree with the U.S. Attorney that it's a reasonable, moderate, incremental action, and that we think presenting these arguments, our arguments, to a federal court is the best way to get a clear resolution.
Let me just summarize what this crack house statute is about, because that seems to be at the heart of this matter. It's a federal statute which makes it a felony. I'm quoting here from uslegal.com, makes it a felony to knowingly open lease, rent, use, or maintain any place for the purpose of manufacturing, distributing, or using any controlled substance. Now, you are talking about opening up a medical facility, essentially, in Philadelphia. How does that intersect with this crack house statute?
We understand the purpose of the crack house statute to dissuade drug use, and you know, strong policies are necessary. Strong laws and policies are necessary to address the opioid crisis. Our focus is different. Our focus is we are opening up a facility for the purpose of saving lives and encouraging folks to get into treatment. A vastly different idea from the intent behind the crack house laws.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation here. And you have looked at some of these sites in Canada and in countries in Europe. I'm curious about just your response to what is happening here in Philadelphia and perhaps even the significance of this particular lawsuit.
Well, you know, Marty, we're dealing with a public health emergency. And so as a researcher, I wanted to learn more about, well, how are other countries dealing with drug-related deaths and disease? And so with eight other colleagues at RAND, I spent the past year looking at two particular interventions, one being heroin-assisted treatment and the other being supervised consumption sites. So in addition to doing a thorough literature review, you know, we talked to key informants in countries with these programs, but then we also spent time talking to individuals here in the United States, frontline treatment staff, as well as we talked to nearly 80 people who use heroin and fentanyl to get their thoughts on about these programs and what they see as the opportunities and barriers. And you know, as was alluded to earlier in the program, there are more than 100 of these supervised consumption sites operating in at least 10 countries. But you know, here in the United States, they're not legally sanctioned. But you know, outside of the United States, most of these programs have been around for 15-30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, persistence doesn't imply effectiveness, but it's unlikely that they would have such longevity if they pose serious adverse consequences for their clients or their communities.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things, and I'll make sure that that both of our guests have a chance to respond to this. But one of the goals, as I understand it, for a safe injection site is to provide a safe place where people can use these drugs. Are they, Bo Kilmer, are these safe places?
Yes. Yes, they are safe. And so as we were doing this literature review, it turns out that the scientific evidence about the effectiveness of the supervised consumption sites is pretty limited in terms of its quality and the locations evaluated. I mean, the bulk of the research is focused on either the site in Vancouver or one in Sydney. I mean, now, the results are generally positive, but most of these studies really don't allow researchers to make strong causal inferences. That said, we identified about 9 studies that we thought were high quality, and of those 9, essentially 4 were replications.
you know, you hear this claim, especially from federal officials, that the supervised consumption sites will create serious public safety risks. And I have to say, just looking at the research on this, I don't see it. We identified three good studies from Sydney, which all suggested that opening up the supervised consumption site there didn't have much of an effect, or didn't have any effect on crime rates. And in fact, there was another study done in Vancouver suggesting, if anything, it actually reduced crime. So this argument that it's going to create these public, these serious public safety risks, I'm just not seeing it in the evidence.
Well, Ron, let me go back to you, and we should say the safe house has not opened yet, but obviously you've got a plan for how it's going to work. Take us to the kind of facilities or how a drug user would essentially use Safe House if it were to open.
We're envisioning a medically supervised model. So step one, a participant walks in, has some registration. There is an assessment of the person's behavioral or physical health needs. And then we ask the person, what is it you want here today? And the person may ask for the opportunity to consume drugs. Person may also ask to go directly to MAT referrals.
MAT?
MAT. So we're envisioning a site that has medication-assisted therapy initiation on the site. And so that if you are coming in the middle of the night and you've decided that you can no longer struggle with this any longer and that you want to get into treatment, we are there. We are ready for treatment. If you decide you are not ready for treatment and that you need to consume because you feel sick at that moment and you can't think of much else, we'll give you a safe place with safe equipment that you can consume. You go into an observation room after you consume, and you're offered a full range of treatment and wraparound services.
And it's they bring their own drugs, so they are not getting drugs from a facility such as this.
We are not providing drugs at this facility. We're providing clean injection equipment, we're providing fentanyl test strips, and we're providing a strong network of wraparound services.
And if someone begins to OD, what happens?
If a person begins to overdose, the medically trained personnel will assess what is the next step. Do they need oxygen? Do they need Narcan? Is this something we can't control here and we should call 911? But the value of having eyes on the person when that overdose starts is what can keep it from becoming a fatal overdose.
Well, I'm curious about whether drug users for the cities where there are these safe injection sites, do drug users use them? Do they come and see these as places where they can go and safely use their drugs?
Yes. Now, for example, in Vancouver, I think they, in 2017, I believe they supervised somewhere around somewhere around 200,000 injections. So you definitely have people coming in. When I was doing my visit there about a year and a half ago, I mean, there was a waiting room at the one there in Vancouver where people were waiting to go in and be able to get access to the clean needles and then, you know, inject in front of someone who is medically trained. And as I said, so it's, a lot of these have been around Europe for quite some time. I mean, the one in Vancouver, Insight, gets a lot of attention in Canada. But I'd say over the past year, a number of these supervised consumption sites have opened up in other parts of the country. And they've also opened up what they're calling overdose prevention sites. And so when you typically think about these supervised consumption sites, you think of them as kind of a separate building where people come in. But what they're doing in Canada in response to this is they're also setting up some of these less structured facilities so they can increase the number of injections that are supervised.
And do we know whether these supervised injection sites, does it get someone off their drugs? I mean, do they use the medical and mental health services that are offered?
Well, definitely some people do use these services, but the question is, well, what would they do in the absence of the supervised consumption site? So as I mentioned before, look, there have been dozens of studies conducted on these sites. That said, only a few of them, I'd say, were kind of high quality in that we could actually begin to look at the causal effect. That is, once you set up one of these facilities, what does it mean for various outcomes? And unfortunately, for the rigorous studies that have been done, none of them have looked at treatment uptake as one of the outcomes.
Interesting. And this was mentioned earlier in the hour by WHYY's Bobby Allen. Let me put this to you, Rhonda, which is, A lot has been made about what Vancouver has done. Is Philadelphia Vancouver? I mean, it seems we have our unique set of challenges in this city.
Of course, Philadelphia is unique, as all cities actually have their own unique flavor. But I think that the best indicator of what could work and what the outcomes in Philadelphia could be are the outcomes in other places. We have a strong drug problem, and we need to take guidance from other places that have had successful interventions. The idea of saying that we're different and so therefore it won't work, we need a little bit more, particularly when the stakes are so high.
And what is the goal? I mean, if Safe House or when Safe House gets to open, what is your goal?
Our goal is to save lives. We will give people options for treatment, but, you know, as you hear a lot of people say, dead people don't go into recovery. Hmm. And so if we keep you alive today, you can make a better choice later.
And that's Rhonda Goldfein. She's vice president of Safe House. That's the nonprofit that got sued this week by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Philadelphia. Also with us, Bo Kilmer. He's a researcher with RAND and has looked at some of the pluses and minuses of some of these supervised injection sites in countries where they are used. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. But let me put this to you, an email from Gerald who said, these are not, quote, overdoses since there is no safe level of heroin, fentanyl, or cocaine that can be used. I mean, having looked at this problem around the world, what do you say in response?
Well, just looking at the data for InSight, so the supervised consumption site in Vancouver, in 2017, they reversed or addressed nearly 2,000 overdoses just in that year. Now, you have to step back. That doesn't mean that the intervention saved 2,000 lives, right? Because, you know, what we want to know is what's the overall effect? That is, if you set up one of these supervised consumption sites, what's that going to mean for the total number of deaths or the total number of people of new infections for HIV or hepatitis C? And this is where it gets difficult in terms of, as I said, we've got this limited research base. You know, for example, if you are a mayor of a city and, you know, someone has given you $3 million, say, to spend on addressing the harms associated with opioids and, you know, especially with fentanyl overdoses, it's not entirely clear to me where you should spend that money. Hmm. You know, do you spend it on a supervised consumption site? Do you maybe, you know, add a number of new syringe exchange programs? Do you maybe increase access to buprenorphine or methadone? And so at this point, we really don't have that type of information to where we can help policymakers understand, well, where are you going to get the most bang for your buck? So that way, so, you know, if one of these does open up in Philadelphia or, you know, they're having serious discussions about this in San Francisco and in Denver and other places, I hope that we build in kind of a strong research component so that way we'll have more information so we can help other jurisdictions think about whether or not this makes sense for them.
Rhonda, you're nodding your head, yes?
Yeah, and I think in the idea of bang for your buck, I agree completely. We want to see what's the best range of services, what's the best approach to addressing the epidemic. Nobody envisions that Safe House will solve the opioid crisis in Kensington. We want to do one little piece. We have one sliver in the problem, and that's we will save lives. And I think that's a whole lot of bang for the buck. And mm-hmm. then the rest of it, I think we need to have thoughtful research like RAND is doing and to look at how we can best use our resources to get the best bang for the buck.
And when you look at staffing Safe House, what kind of staffing do you envision?
We envision medically supervised personnel. I mean, this is a medical intervention, and so we're looking at folks in a range of disciplines, but that will be medically trained to assess the appropriate response if a person should begin an overdose. And then because we're going to offer other services there, primary mm-hmm. care, wound care, counseling, we'll have people in appropriate disciplines to provide that care.
Here's a question from Sandy. What does the data or research show about whether or not saving a life from overdosing changes a person's addiction or changes their life? And I guess in many ways, Bo, this is really the heart of the matter and probably the most difficult part of this problem.
No, you're correct. And so one of the big questions about when people begin looking at the evidence on supervised consumption sites and they begin looking at the cost effectiveness, you know, a lot of it comes down to assumptions about, well, how does participation in the supervised consumption site, how does that affect behavior outside, you know, when they're injecting, you know, in other places and not necessarily at the facility? And this is an area where we just need more research right. in terms of how, you know, how participation, you know, has an effect on the activities outside of the facility. But the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, there's a lot of different types of these supervised consumption sites in terms of the different types of services they provide. You know, some of them do provide access to the testing strips. You know, some of them have treatment facilities nearby. So there are a lot of different ways that you can do this in terms of doing more than just kind of overseeing the injections.
Bobetta, yeah, go ahead. You want to add to that, Rhonda?
Yeah, I also think it's always important to keep people in this equation. I mean, data makes it all run, and we're grateful for it. But, you know, how does saving a person's life influence their behavior going forward? Well, they're alive, so let's start there.
Right.
Like, we just can't kind of skip over that as just a factor. That is a prime factor.
And obviously, they're alive to use drugs again. They're alive to do...
They're alive to get into recovery.
Or recovery as well. But you're saying from your perspective at this point... In the city with a crisis of this proportion, let's start there.
I think if we talk to the families of the, you know, 1,200 people the year before, 1,100 people last year, and say, would have kept keeping your loved one alive made a difference? Would that have been sufficient? I mean, you know, I think that's where we need to focus. Research, for sure. But let's keep folks alive to start with.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Rhonda Goldfein, and she's vice president and co-founder of Safe House, and that's the safe injection site that is the subject of a lawsuit from the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Philadelphia. Got a lot of press this week. She's also executive director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Bo Kilmer and Rhonda Goldfein about Safe House and safe injection sites. There is a proposed one here in Philadelphia that's now the subject of a civil lawsuit filed earlier this week by the Eastern District of Pennsylvania U.S. Attorney William McSwain. And let me go back to one more clip from the interview that he did with WHYY's Bobby Allen. And let's play that clip and then we'll carry on our conversation.
That doesn't mean that you're not going to overdose when you're not in the site. And it doesn't mean that there couldn't be other effects, other negative effects of having a site where more people are, for example, getting hooked on drugs or trying drugs because they think it's safe or they think it's legitimate or they think it's legal. And we don't want to attract people to going down this path of drug dependency, which destroys their lives.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that, Bo Kilmer. Based on the research that you have done, does having a safe injection site encourage drug use?
That's a claim that's often made, but the strong research that's been done on this just really hasn't examined that outcome.
Oh, so you haven't really looked at it yet?
Oh, no, I've looked at it. You know, we were reviewing the research on this. As I said, there have been dozens of studies done, but we only identified 9 of them, which would really allow us to begin to understand the causal effect of opening up a supervised consumption site. And of those 9 studies, none of those looked at that particular outcome.
Hmm. Let's say Safe House does open. We don't know if it will or not. What, Bo Kilmer, would you like to learn from what might be happening in Philadelphia?
Well, what I would like to do is, you know, if you were designing a, a research project around this, you'd want to begin thinking about, well, you know, what are the comparison areas? You know, this is, would be targeted in Kensington, but what are the other parts of Philadelphia or even nearby cities which wouldn't necessarily be close to the supervised consumption site that would actually kind of serve as a potential control group? And what I would want to do is I'd want to start talking to the people who use heroin and fentanyl in those areas. So in Kensington as well as in the other comparison areas, you know, begin talking to them about their consumption, how frequently they're consuming. You'd also want information about, ideally you like information, blood tests. You could, look at what potentially happens with the spread of HIV and hepatitis C, number of overdoses. And ideally what you'd want to do is, then kind of follow those people over time after the supervised consumption site then opens up in Kensington. So then that way you're looking at people who are near the facility versus those that are not close to the facility and kind of looking at them before and after. This is what researchers call a differences in differences design. And that would be quite useful in terms of really understanding kind of the causal effect of this program. And then you could also – there's – it doesn't seem the claim that opening up a supervised consumption site is going to increase the prevalence of use because it's going to make it seem safer – you have to kind of step back because realize, people are still overdosing. Right. And people, and so it's not necessarily saying that it's safe. But what these facilities are doing is when the substance use is supervised, it does at that time it does reduce the probability that the individual dies.
Well, Rhonda, let me go back to you. You're executive director of the AIDS Law Project of Pennsylvania, and earlier this week at the State of the Union, President Trump talked about eliminating the AIDS HIV. But I'm wondering whether a safe injection site would help to do that and whether we have learned anything from needle exchange.
So, yes, we've learned from needle exchange. SafeHouse was founded by me and my colleague Jose Benitez from Prevention Point and Governor Ed Rendell. And 26 years ago, Governor Ed Rendell authorized the opening of Prevention Point and allowed for syringe exchange. At that time, unclean needles were contributed to 50% of the new HIV infections in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. That number is now down to less than 5%.
Wow. So because of needle exchange.
Because of needle exchange. And so the science is clear that giving folks access to clean needles will reduce HIV infection. Among the services that SafeHouse will provide is clean injection equipment and create an environment where folks will develop trust relationships and want to come back in and want to get that treatment. This is a strong measure that can, in fact, reduce HIV infection. So it was with some painful irony we heard the president say he's committed to ending HIV infection, and then the next day the Department of Justice tries to shut down this initiative.
Yeah, interesting. Let me get Carol. Did you want to add something quickly, Bo?
I just wanted to add in terms of, as a researcher, we're looking for outcomes that we can measure, but there's important aspects of supervised consumption sites in terms of reducing stigma and, and showing, and respecting those individuals who are consuming heroin and fentanyl and other substances. Some of these outcomes, which can be very important for people, are just really hard to measure. Right. So that's the other thing to kind of keep in mind. Look, I'm a researcher and I care about numbers and making sure we make strong causal inferences, but we also have to realize there can be important consequences of these interventions that are just really hard to measure.
I hear you. Let me get Caroline from, looks like Malvern, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Caroline. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. I'd just like to thank you for having this this conversation this
sure.
morning, and thank your two guests for appearing. I am both a nurse and a paramedic, and I find myself very frustrated whenever I hear our elected leaders discussing this problem. Because it seems to me that they focus way too much on the end result of this discussion, i.e., do supervised injection sites increase crime? Do they promote drug use? Whereas they seem to ignore the fact that right now we have far too little rehab capacity in the country for right. all of the drug addicts that we do have, okay? We just don't have the capacity to care for all of the people that have this problem. And that in the meantime, we really need to work on harm reduction, and that's what safe injection sites are, because IV drug abuse is inherently very dangerous, and harm reduction strategies like safe injection sites don't make it safe. They make it safer.
I hear you.
And
you know, Karen, I appreciate the call, and let me give Rhonda, you nodded your head when she made a couple of those comments. Rhonda, go ahead.
I think that's the exact point, that harm reduction is a public health strategy to get people to move forward. We learned clearly in the Reagan era that just say no doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so we have to meet folks where they are. And where they are is dying at a huge rate in Philadelphia. We have to offer, as the caller said, a safer alternative. And we're not saying the drugs are safe. On the contrary, these drugs are awful. And that's why if you're going to use them and people are using them, don't do it alone. Do it in front of somebody who can save your life.
Well, and I'm trying to imagine someone working, obviously these are trained people, but nonetheless working at a safe injection site and seeing people doing harm to themselves. That's got to be important, but a difficult job to have.
All of this is difficult. The folks at Prevention Point do a tremendous job. I think in the first quarter of 2018, they may have reversed more than 200 overdoses in their building or on the premises. It's all hard stuff, but we can't say this is too hard, or we can't allow our moral purity stop us from doing the right thing.
Here's a question from Dylan. I'll put this to you, Bo. Dylan says, as a person in recovery, I was wondering what your guests thought of medically assisted treatments such as methadone. And you mentioned at the start of our conversation about heroin assisted treatment. Help us understand what you're saying there.
Yeah. So, in our report, we looked at two of these different interventions, one being supervised consumption sites and the other being heroin-assisted treatment, which is actually used in it's been done in Canada as mm-hmm. well as in a few European countries. And here, and this is an intervention. This is not legalizing heroin. For the countries that allow heroin-assisted treatment, it's not as if someone's going to go to the CVS or the equivalent there and just get pharmaceutical-grade heroin. But the goal here is for those people who've been using for 10, 20 years, and they've tried methadone and other treatments multiple times, and they still haven't been able to reduce their heroin consumption. What they've done in some of these countries is that they'll actually allow people to – this is different from a supervised consumption site. This is a facility where people come in and they inject heroin that's actually prescribed wow. by a medical official. And so the goal here is to, one, reduce their consumption of street-sourced heroin, but it's also intended to stabilize their lives. Realize people who've been using for quite some time, they're either spend most of their day intoxicated or they're spending a lot of their time trying to obtain funds in order to purchase more drugs, oftentimes putting themselves in very dangerous situations. And so what we did as part of this report is we looked at the evidence for this particular intervention, and it turns out the evidence is much stronger with respect to heroin-assisted treatment. There have been at least 10 different randomized controlled trials. And the evidence there was quite solid that for some individuals, this can actually make a difference. Now, I want to be clear that this isn't a first or a second line approach, but kind of based on the evidence and kind of based on where we are with fentanyl in the United States, our recommendation is that in a few cities in the U.S., we should do some randomized controlled trials, seeing if heroin-assisted treatment has the same effects here as it does as we see in other countries.
And where are these other countries? I'm just curious, Bo, and then we'll give Rhonda a chance to respond. Where are people using heroin-assisted treatment?
So you've got it in Vancouver. You've got it in the UK, Switzerland, the Netherlands, mm-hmm. and a couple other European countries.
You want to add to that, Rhonda?
It's not often that I am the less liberal voice on this issue, but I agree with Bo completely. I mean, we are not there yet, not that we don't support it and agree with it, but that we are trying to move forward with an initiative we think we can accomplish.
Let me get, it looks like Nadine from North Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Nadine, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I am Nadine Blackwell, and I'm a registered nurse and a low-vision therapist, and I have worked in public health before becoming disabled, but I still volunteer in my community doing health education. And I live in the real North Philly, which the developers have renamed Brewery Town and Francis, you know, those such things.
Right.
I want to say that I applaud the Attorney General because we come up with these programs that don't do anything. I have seen methadone centers were supposed to have wraparound services. Haven't seen it. We are putting money into having Safe House do what they propose to do, but yet and still, as this is a public health problem, why are our public health centers being drained of money to help treat people who had a place to come for primary care? We are talking about, we're not addressing the other industries that spring up around these type of methadone treatment centers, such as people selling their IDs for money, loan sharks who are there because many of these people get disability. And I come from a family where I've seen many people addicted to different types of things. We have not chosen to address all of the problems associated with crack, which are still pervasive in our neighborhoods. And I want to know, are these sites ever going to be in a neighborhood with the people who run these centers? Is it ever going to be in your neighborhood? I live in a neighborhood, even though it's being gentrified, where we have everything. We have re-entry places. We have houses for people who have been convicted of molesting children, where they now live in peace, and that,
you know,
all of that is fine. But
sure,
I haven't seen those wraparound.
No, you raised so many good points, and I really appreciate you calling into Radio Times. I had to jump in there only because I know our guests want to respond to what she described, and I'll put that first to you, Rhonda, which is I think she raises some really valid points there.
She certainly does, and we have all seen a disappointment in certain facilities that are designed to provide care. We can't kind of let the poor performance of others dictate where we move forward on this initiative. We're envisioning a privately funded initiative, and that's going to provide this full range of services. Folks have heard it before with other places, but this is what we're envisioning. We're also envisioning this as a model for care. So we're not saying put one in the middle of Kensington and we've done our work. We actually think that looking at a map of Philadelphia and see where the need is and having several sites throughout the city so that there are resources available for all Philadelphians.
Anything you want to add to that, Bo Kilmer? I know you're not here in Philadelphia with us, but just your thoughts, Nadine said.
Nothing to add to that.
Nothing to add to that. I'm curious whether, and we have about a minute or so before we have to end our conversation, and this is to you, Bo Kilmer, whether doing this research is hard to do because you are essentially, especially in America, you are researching a drug that is illegal.
Yeah, no, there are challenges in terms of doing research on illicit drug policies. When we think about the federal government here, and we spent some time talking about this earlier in the show, you know, they have many options when it comes to supervised consumption sites. And I think here it's important to look at what happened with cannabis legalization. You know, after Washington and Colorado legalized in November of 2012, no one was quite sure what the federal government was going to do. And it wasn't until August of 2013 that the Department of Justice released a memo and said, hey, look, this is still all illegal under federal law, mm-hmm. but for the time being, we're not going to intervene as long as the states, abide by these guidelines. And one could imagine doing something similar with the supervised consumption sites. You know, the Department of Justice could release a memo saying, look, this is all illegal under federal law, but, you know, we're going to set up these guidelines. And for example, if you're a supervised consumption site and you've built in kind of a rigorous research component so we can learn from the intervention, we're not going to intervene. So that's just one example. There are a lot of options there.
Well, much to talk about. Bo Kilmer, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's co-director of RAND Drug Policy Research Center. And Rhonda Goldfein, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you for your interest.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.